of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 4 p.m. on Thursday, November 3rd, in the auditorium of the Beckman Center on the University of Illinois campus, the Illinois Geological Survey is presenting a public lecture titled The Secret Search for Diamonds in North America by award-winning science journalist Kevin Krajcik.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of this country's most controversial editorial political cartoonists. His name is Ted Rall. His work is syndicated in over 140 publications around the country. His cartoons appear in the Philadelphia Daily News, the LA Times, the Village Voice, the San Jose Mercury News, the New York Times, among others. He's published three collections of cartoons. Tunes, Waking Up in America, All the Rules Have Changed, and Search and Destroy. He also writes a weekly op-ed column. He's authored four prose and graphic novels. His first, widely acclaimed, critically acclaimed, was titled Real Americans Admit the Worst Thing I've Ever Done, and it is a collection of real-life stories of people's worst deeds in comic form. He's also published recently two books. One, it's titled Attitude, The New Subversive Political Cartoonists, which is a collection of alternative cartoonists, and also a book that was based on his experiences covering the war in Afghanistan for both the Village Voice and KFI Radio, that book, To Afghanistan and Back. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 1996, was one of the New York Times' most reprinted cartoonists in 97, 99, and 2001, and was awarded the 1998 Deadline Club Award by the Society of Professional Journalists for his cartoons. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. The title is The Slow Motion Suicide of the American Empire, and that's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. That's on Illinois Street in Urbana on the U of I campus. These programs are always free and open to the public, and anybody interested in attending should feel welcome. This morning, as we talk with Ted Rall, also calls are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, David.
I appreciate it. The place I thought maybe we might start is to talk a little bit about the state of political editorial cartooning, because I know I've read a lot of comments, a lot of your comments on the subject, saying that you think that it's a dying art, and that in one of the interviews with you I read, you said that in fact you thought probably in the not too distant future you wouldn't be doing it anymore. Where is political cartooning going?
It's disappearing. It's really a mixed bag. What we've seen since 9/11 is that there's been an increasing demand for editorial cartoons from the public. Readers really want to see them. They're resonating and being commented upon more than ever before, and they've assumed a life of their own on the internet. In fact, my next book in the Attitude Theory series is called Attitude 3, The Subversive New Media Cartoonists, and it's only about webcomics. So there's never been more of a market for them, at least as an idea. But the problem is that in print, as an economic model, editorial cartoons are in incredible danger. And I should say it's almost like the polar ice cap. It's pretty much doomed. Back in 1980, the estimate was that there were about 285 working full-time editorial cartoonists. At this time, there's fewer than 50. And that number continues to decline. Newspapers are consolidating. Each time two newspapers become one, that's an editorial cartoonist, that job that disappears. There's also newspapers that are not replacing their editorial cartoonists when they retire or die. Jeff McNally famously died at the Chicago Tribune a couple of years ago and has been famously not been replaced. Mm-hmm. That's just one example. If a paper that size isn't going to replace its cartoonist, it's not a financial decision. The editors just don't really want to run them. And there's also an economic problem caused by people like me, ironically, who are syndicated only. It's very cheap to buy syndicated material. A newspaper might pay $20 for three cartoons a week from me. If they had to hire me, they'd have to pay me a salary and benefits, and I would probably break a lot of office furniture. I don't know. So they're
you have that reputation.
Yes. So it's a very It's kind of a it's really a weird situation because the readers want the stuff, we want to draw it, but these editors are in our way and are preventing us from getting to our public. And people say, well, let's look at the internet as an alternate model. It's a great distribution model, but it doesn't filter. You don't filter out for quality, which an editor or a newspaper or a magazine can do. And it, there's also a huge problem with the fact that there's no economic reward for the cartoonist. So a lot of people who start who go into this, they'd get tired of working for free after a while, mm-hmm. and they just go away and stop. So it's I have to be pessimistic about the form, although it's never been more vibrant in, yeah. as an art form.
Well, I think on the one hand, you'd think that because we've gotten away from this model that starts with a cartoonist that works for a newspaper and draws cartoons for that paper, and then if that person, you know, who knows what the syndicators what they're looking for, but if they think somebody's worth syndicating, then they'll pick that up and will then sell that to other papers and give the cartoonist a very small amount of money. And I know, and as you've explained in some of the stuff that I've read, the idea was at one time, well, this was a person who had a full-time job, and this is just a little something extra, the syndication fee. Nobody thought anybody was going to live off the amount of money that you could get for a syndication fee. So we've gotten away from that model. So that's difficult on the one hand, but I would think on the other hand that it might give cartoonists – maybe you can't live, but it might give cartoonists greater freedom because at least you don't have to get the cartoon past the editor of your paper in the first place. You can sort of do whatever you want, and then I guess it will be up to the editors at the papers who buy the cartoons from the syndicator to look at the cartoons and decide, am I going to run this one or am I not?
Yeah, that you sound exactly like many of my peers who work at papers and who say that I shouldn't be jealous of their 401ks. And they say, yeah, but Raul, you have so much freedom. Yeah. You can draw whatever you want. You can do these crazy anti-Bush cartoons and you can bash the 9/11 widows or do whatever you want and it doesn't matter. And that's more or less true. No one person can fire me. And so the worst thing that can happen to me is I could lose a bunch of clients, but the chances of losing all of them all at once, it's really slim to none.
Yeah. As I mentioned, and you've talked about a couple of specific cartoons or subjects that have drawn some fire, your work's been controversial. It has upset a lot of people. You've gotten a lot of hate mail. I understand you've even gotten death threats. And I'm sure on the one hand, you would argue that any editorial cartoonist who doesn't make people angry is not doing his job. You should make people angry, but there comes a point.
Or you should be willing to make people angry, I think is a better way to put it. It's not my intention to make anyone angry. I mean, I don't try to make anyone angry in real life. Why would I try to do it through my work? But at the same time, if I have an idea that I feel is important and needs to be expressed, I'm not going to pull my punches because someone might get angry. And I think that's really...
Well, do you? I wonder how much of that angry reaction is some people who genuinely understand the point that you're making, and who just think that you're flat out wrong, and it's so outrageous they're just incensed. And how much of it is people who just don't quite get it, who don't understand that irony and satire is being employed here, and that it doesn't that you're trying to make a point about American politics, and that you're not making a personal statement of, well, I suppose you are making a personal statement of your politics, but that they're not reading it quite right.
Yeah, I mean, both are going on. It's very complicated to try to parse why certain cartoons get an outsized angry reaction. And, some people have posited that it's the cartoonist's fault because those cartoons tend to have a little more ambiguity and be less straightforward than the cartoons that don't have that kind of response. When a cartoon is really straightforward and has a strident political opinion behind it, even people who don't agree with it who vehemently disagree with it, they tend to just dismiss it because they get it and they hate it and they throw it and they, you know, it's fish wrapper later. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking at but the cartoons, like in my case, my Terror Widows cartoon, my Pat Tillman cartoons, these cartoons often relied on a knowledge of the news that was maybe a little unreasonable for me to have expected. You know, I did I mentioned this Terror Widows cartoon, which was in reaction to people who, after 9/11, had gone on television to use the deaths of their spouses on 9/11 to promote books or a political agenda, or in one case, a born again Christianity. And I said, and the cartoon is sending up the media, the way that the media portrays these people and allows itself to be used. But many of the people who were angry had never seen the same appearances on CNN or MSNBC that I had seen, that I was commenting on. You know, you're a cartoonist, you're a political cartoonist, you've got the cable news on 24/7, you're listening to NPR and everything. So you're reading the Washington Post and the New York Times and your local paper. So you can get into this space where people are, you know, they say, well, I didn't see that. That never happened. So this person's out of his mind. That's outrageous. That's crazy. So these people, they're not really in a position to really comment about what you drew, because they don't have the background to understand it. It's kind of like someone who's unfamiliar with urban life being angry at what rappers are doing. It's, you know, they just don't have the background. And at the same time, it's our jobs as cartoonists to communicate and to explain stories that may be a little bit more obscure, or sometimes to pass them up. So it's really complicated. I mean, I tend to take more of the responsibility on myself when that sort of thing happens, even because it's not reasonable to expect people who are working 50-hour weeks to have seen all the same things I have.
Hmm. Well, do you then, if you get that kind of reaction, then do you say to yourself, well, that ultimately that cartoon was not successful, that somehow I, Ted Rall, failed at this?
Yeah, I guess 90% of it is I do. I think, you know, the job is to skewer sacred cows. And if people are angry at you strictly because of the fact that you took on their sacred, that you gutted their sacred cow, that's fine with me. But if they're angry because there's something, I didn't provide them with a piece of information that they needed to understand what I was getting at, that's my fault. And, I look at some of my more controversial cartoons as failures in that respect. I don't take them back, but I hardly look at anything I've ever drawn and without thinking, you know, I should have added this or taken this out, or this could have been simpler. I mean, when I'm going through right now, I have I'm working on my next collection of cartoons that comes out next spring. And I was just, you know, picking the cartoons, and you know, there's almost none of them are perfect. Really, like 1 out of 100. I'm like, oh, that one's good. I wouldn't change anything. For the most part, I'm always, I can't believe I did that.
Well, in the preliminary stages, once you have an idea and you're starting to work it out and starting to think about what you're doing, are there points when you look at it and look at what you're saying and you say to yourself, no, I can't do this. I shouldn't do this, or I better not do this.
I'm scaring myself.
Or yes. And it's that even for you, you think, oh, this one is over the top. We're not going to do that. And you need to take that and put it in the trash.
You know, very rarely, because usually if I get one that's so hot where I'm like, oh my God, do I dare unleash this Enola Gay on an unsuspecting public? I think, you know, then I'm usually like, if it scares me, that's why I should do it. The job is really about expressing uncomfortable opinions and truths, ideally. And if I can't, I'm not. You should never back away from that sort of thing, unless it's just simply an issue of taste. I'm working on a possible idea for next week, where I was going to refer to John McCain's proposal to officially ban torture from a defense appropriations bill among detainees being held by the U.S. government. And my idea was, to have a what if John McCain do a sort of an alternate reality where John McCain proposes that detainees can no longer be raped in Guantanamo and other places where that's happened and it's something that nobody talks about, and so how graphic do I want to get into in the cartoon? What language do I use to describe the act of rape? And, you know, I realize I want to go all the way up to that line, because anything that's it, the cartoon, I have several drafts of this cartoon, and the ones that use sort of more polite language, sexual molestation, for instance, is not as effective as saying things that I'm not going to say here. Don't worry, but I will probably use in my cartoon, and it probably will cause outrage because the situation's outrageous. It requires people to be slapped across the face as they're eating their Wheaties in the morning. So yeah. You need to do that. It's not something you want to do with every cartoon, but sometimes the joke calls for it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ted Rall. He's a political cartoonist. His work appears in more than 140 publications across the country. He's published 3 collections of cartoons. He writes a weekly op-ed column, has authored 4 prose and graphic books. And if you're interested in sampling some of his work and perhaps that of other cartoonists who take the same approach, you might want to look at a book that came out just a couple of years ago entitled Attitude, the New Subversive Political Cartoonists. Has there been more than one collection like that?
There's a sequel, Attitude 2, and then a third one's coming out next year.
And that's going to be the one that's all cartoonists that distribute via the internet.
That's right, exactly.
Okay. He's here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk in the MillerCom series. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can stop by and hear him. Also here on the program, questions are welcome. We have a couple of people ready to go. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign County, and that's line 1. Hello.
Hi. I see from your article about the Cheney Gate that you've been in town for a couple of days, so welcome. I didn't know about your speaking at all. I assume you're doing some kind of visual presentation, too, with your talk? Or?
I will.
Okay. I called earlier when you were – I thought to call earlier when you were talking about funding it, and I'm wondering whether you could do anything like Salon does where you have to watch a little ad before you can get a pass for the day or something like that. And I'm not advocating that, and I don't know how many Ben & Jerry's would actually run an ad in front of a flash cartoon of yours or something like that. But I guess I just hope you keep doing it because it reminds me of the satirist Lehrer
– Jonathan?
Yeah, well, I forget. He's a mathematician. He gave up doing satire when Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize. He said,
"Wasn't it Tom Lehrer?"
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom Lehrer. Yes, Tom Lehrer. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So, but I given that you're going to write something, draw something on this, I just you know I'm overwhelmed by how absurd things have gotten, and it's like it's kind of hard to keep doing it humorously, but you know it's a way of coping, I guess. But after watching Meet the Press this past week, when they're the spin doctors are trying to spin out of this Libbygate, where we have William Sapphire, who's a grammarian, supposedly turning Fitzgerald's noting that that Fitzgerald said we're making no allegations about the underlying charges. Sapphire turns that into there is no conspiracy. And then when you're watching that, and then David Brooks goes on and says, they've been fully cooperating. The White House has been fully cooperating. When the guy's being indicted for obstruction of justice and perjury, his idea of fully cooperation, I mean, if you're getting my drift, it's so surreal. Neither of these gentlemen were challenged on either of these absolutely ridiculous statements. So maybe you can ridicule a little bit of that, too. I don't know if you actually watched that episode and noted those same things. But, okay, well, I guess that's enough of my rant for the day. Thank you very much.
That's okay. I get to do my rants in cartoon and column form every week. You know, I mean, it's the caller is obviously been, like many of us, driven to distraction by the insanity of the Bush administration and maybe even worse, the complicity of the mainstream media in promoting their insane agenda. And it has, you know, I mean, it's funny. I remember at one point during the Clinton impeachment reading, I forget which conservative pundit it was who said that the conservatives among them had been driven insane by Clinton, that he had driven them to distraction. And, you know, it's certainly, and now the accusation is that it's gone the other way. There's a little truth to it. You know, I mean, it's really hard. And I think if you to read, as I do, as a New Yorker, waking up every morning and reading the op-ed page of the New York Times, which features some of the writers that, like David Brooks, that were mentioned, you know, it is just – you get to the point where you just throw up your hands and you just give up. I know so many people – my wife won't even watch the news anymore. She will yell at me if I have it on. She will throw things at the television whenever Bush comes on or any of those guys. And it's really hard. It's hard for, I think, anyone who cares about the state of the republic. But it's, in a way, really hard for people who are trying to do what I'm trying to do, because we have to kind of keep a certain sardonic distance from. We have to not care that much. We just have to think it's kind of funny and push for what's right. But you know, it's. This isn't George Herbert Walker Bush. It's not Ronald Reagan even. It's a whole different scenario. And for many of us, these have been, as Paul Krugman, also of the New York Times, wrote, these have been the nightmare years. And it seems like with this first indictment, maybe that's starting to come to an end.
Well, you have the opportunity. Some people don't have any outlet at all. You have the opportunity to actually vent – to talk about things that really concern you. It's as if there's something that you think's not getting attention from other journalists, you have the opportunity to take the big finger and point it and say, "Here, look at this." And you know, does that make you feel any better about things, or does that just mean that, well, you can, at least for you yourself, you can get it off your chest?
You know, maybe I have the wrong attitude about it, but I almost feel like I've. You know, once I've sent out my cartoons and my columns for the week, I'm done. I've done my part. You know, it's like I think about, you know, when WMDs didn't turn up in Iraq after the invasion, you know, and people were like, oh, my. And I had friends who were shocked and amazed that there were none. And I kept pointing them to the columns that I'd written that quoted CIA sources who said that they were relatively certain that there were none 2 years before the war. And, you know, I was like, look, we told you. And if you didn't want to listen, it's your fault. You know, I kind of feel like one day I'm going to be sitting under a broken down freeway overpass grilling rats over a fire in a barrel, and people will be whining and I'll be like, I told you so. I told you. I don't know what satisfaction I'm supposed to get out of that. But and yet I do. I kind of feel like no one person – you know, I think can change the world. You know, people point to people like Rosa Parks, important, but, you know, she didn't do it by herself. And I think all you can do in your own small way, in my own small way, is to try to get people to think about something that they might not have thought of, or maybe to think about something in a new way or something. So it is nice to have the outlet. I don't think it, you know, really changes anything.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk with somebody here. Well, we have somebody on cell phone. My apologies. I kept him waiting too long. Let's go on to Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I fully empathize with your wife. However, you know, that image of you barbecuing the rats under the freeway, I'm always reminded of R.C. Crumb's cartoon where he depicts that transition of a rural tranquil environment to the blighted urban landscape that we have. So your imagery was really quite wonderful. Anatoly Roy refers to the present-day Bush as Bush the Lesser. I think that's a really appropriate way of, you know, visualizing the guy. But the question I had for you is, and this is a serious one, there was an item in the news recently about some kid who was throwing darts at some enlarged image of a Bush, and the clerk didn't like it and contacted the police or the FBI, and it became a topic in the news. How close can you or other cartoonists get to skewering Bush in a very, you know, a vivid way?
Well, I think I think you can look at any of the cartoonists who are – a lot of cartoonists who are working today, really dozens of them, who do very hard-hitting work and are willing to go right up to and maybe cross the line of decency and propriety. And there's really very few limits. I think we've decided to see what it's going to take to get us thrown – one of us thrown into Gitmo. But the one – I know that for myself, the place that I will not go, and that is, of course, obviously a felony, is to threaten or to do any kind of implied threat of against an official, you know, like where there's an imagery of violence or – and that in a cartoon, you have to be really careful because this can come up in a subtle way. There's a cartoonist who I will not name who did sort of a Bush in the bunker during the final days when, you know, with an obvious Hitler analogy. And, you know, I looked at that cartoon and I thought, God, you know, he could probably be prosecuted for that cartoon because it makes it look like he's thinking that he wants Bush to kill himself. And he's like walking up to that line. And I think, you know, it's a terrifying statement about the state of political dialogue in this country that this president elicits this level of contempt from people who are working, employed, professional artists. But at the same time, in terms of the limits, it doesn't seem – I think that most of the fear and censorship that we've seen in our that we've seen in political cartooning since 2000 has really been self-imposed or imposed by editors and publishers. It's not been coming really from the government.
Mm-hmm. Here's a theoretical question for you. On the news earlier this morning, there's a conference, and Bush is going to attend it in South America. He obviously is going to fly. And I was just wondering, as David was introducing you as a cartoonist, where anyone in the cartoon realm would even contemplate this realm of wishful thinking for all manner of people who hear about this, who are incarcerated, thinking, we hope the plane crashes. Can you imagine a cartoonist doing that?
I can imagine anything, but I don't think that would be I know that is not a cartoon that I would draw. I remember getting together with a bunch of cartoonists after the grenade was found under – the undetonated grenade was found under the reviewing stand where Bush had appeared, I believe, in Ukraine, or was it Belarus, one of them. And it turns out that it was very – if it had gone off, it probably would have injured him at least. And, you know, several people would, you know, around the table were saying things like, you know, where's John Hinckley when you need him and stuff like that. And you know, I remember just feeling really uncomfortable about it because I don't think there's anyone in America who has a lower opinion of Bush as a human being and as a leader. But at the same time, you know, it's just in a way, it's just going too far. And I think, you know, it's. Frankly, I'm, you know, it's just common sense that you just don't go there.
Mm-hmm. Right. David, you got time for one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Speaking of the op-ed section of the New York Times this last Sunday, Week in Review, Nicholas Kristof writes this article, and one of the things he says as a remedy for Bush's dilemma is that, first of all, Democrats should wipe the smiles off their face, and that is a humiliation for the entire country. And I read that, and two thoughts occurred to me, and I was wondering if any cartoonists pick up on this. I mean, here is a guy who is clearly an apologist for the gang of hooligans in the White House. And his first aspect of remedy is to chastise people who had nothing to do with this at all. And it occurs to me that these guys are always providing ripe fodder for you cartoonists because their perspective of the world is so cockeyed.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I did a cartoon that's going to probably be posted online on Monday. That's in direct response to that Nicholas Kristof piece, because my jaw dropped when I read that. I was thinking, we've been crying for 5 years and now we're not allowed to smile about Scooter Libby. I'll be damned if I wipe that smile off my face. And I am laughing. It's about time. It couldn't happen to a more deserving group of guys.
Right.
But at the same time, so I wrote this, but you know, it does sort of go to the Kristoff. You know, he considers himself a moderate Democrat, and the Kristoff piece really does. It sort of prompts the old question: where are the Democrats? Why aren't they fighting? All they do is talk. And, they vote Republican on taxes, on the war in Iraq, on funding the war in Iraq, and then they just kind of whine about it afterwards. And that's how they're representing their constituents. And so anyway, I did this cartoon called The Evolution of the Left, which is a takeoff on the old evolution, this classic evolution from Darwinistic evolution from the apes to the Australopithecines to Homo erectus to – and of course it's backwards, and you start out with the PC CP guy, a communist labor guy in the 1920s. With his fist up in the air, and then there's the 60s hippie with the beard, and he's got the peace sign poster up, and then you've got and then there's politically correct guy from the 80s who's kind of wimpy and slouched over, and he's going into the sea, and then finally the last guy is like slouched 2005 Democrat on a sofa watching TV, and he's screaming at the TV, "Thank God for the right wing, they're really kicking Republican butt," after the Harriet Myers thing. And, I was like, what kind of, where is the – we don't live in a two-party system. We live in a no-party system.
Right.
It's, the Democrats with these days are just out to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat from the jaws of victory.
Right.
And it's an astonishing thing to watch. You know, they just don't like winning.
It's been a delight having you as a guest.
Thanks for the call. See, here people now will clearly see that while you are a guy who is on the left side of the political spectrum, that you will attack your own side. Do you hear from liberals who say, "Hey, go ahead, attack the conservatives if you want, but don't hammer on us"?
Oh yeah, all the time. It seems like it's an issue of loyalty for them, and what they don't get is my loyalty isn't to a party. You know, I'm not Howard Dean doesn't write my checks. You know, Universal Press Syndicate writes my checks, and my loyalty is really to myself and my ideas, and to be honest and straightforward. And you know, anybody who really was familiar with my work before Bush came along knows that I was ferocious about Bill Clinton. I came out in favor of his impeachment. I thought that he lying under oath was wrong, especially for a lawyer, and that he deserved it. Little did I know that that would seem so trivial later on. I think it's your job to be, as long as there are people to criticize who are doing things that are worth criticizing, you're there to criticize them. It's a negative job. You're not supposed to be on anyone's side. I admire what John McCain's doing right now with the torture provision. I think it's great. And that's why I will not write about it or draw a cartoon about it, because it's not – until all injustice is eradicated from the world, the editorial cartoonist's job is not to comment on the good stuff. You know, they have their PR flags.
You know, I think that anybody who thinks that politics today is at a bare-knuckle personal level unlike it's ever been doesn't know anything about history, because if all you have to do is look back in American history and see times when it was much, much worse, much more bare-knuckle, much more personal the way that they went after people. Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, some long list of others. And I ask you, as a somebody who has an honors degree in history from Columbia University, do you think that somehow that the level of vitriol in politics today is somehow any different or any worse, or is it very much in the way that American politics always has been?
You know, I think it's all. I think from what I can tell, it's always been this way. I can't think of any time in our history though when one party was so totally emasculated. I don't think the minority party has always been willing to fight back to some extent. And you just don't see that now. I mean, the Democrats have completely and totally rolled over. The strategy of voting along with your enemies seems to be sort of a post-1980s phenomenon. So it's but I do think the anger is always – you know, this ultimately politics is about, I think, tribes. It's almost about – you know, what kind of person you are, you know, who did you sit with, what kind of, which table did you sit at in the lunchroom in junior high school? You know, were you a freak or a geek or a jock or what? And it sort of determines what we have in America has always been a war between rural and urban areas, between the North and the South, the East and the West. There's fault lines along race and class. Maybe if Hillary Clinton becomes the Democratic nominee in 2008, between gender, possibly. So, you know, those fault lines they're just continuous. And what's new about the current situation, in my view, is that an entire a very substantial percentage of the public, nearly half, believes that the president was illegitimately elected. That was installed, as I do. I don't believe that he won the 2000 election, or for that matter, the 2004 election, because if he was illegally installed in 2000, he couldn't run as an incumbent in 2004. And so that's new. I know there's some precedent in the Hayes election in the 19th century, but that was, again, a sleazy but constitutionally legal deal as opposed to an unconstitutional deal. I think the system of government broke down in December 2000, and that has made us crazy. That's why we're at each other's throats. We're not talking about the same things when we talk about Democrats and Republicans debating what's best for America. Democrats are thinking of, or liberals tend to think of America as a country of rights, where we're defined by our rights to privacy or even to bear arms, or just our rights as defined in the Bill of Rights. Whereas conservatives these days tend to think of us more as a superpower, and they take pride in our country's economic and military strength. And those are just two really different visions, and so we're not even talking the same language. And there haven't been many times when in our history when I think you weren't even talking about the same thing. We can't argue because our terms aren't even defined.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is political cartoonist Ted Rall. His work appears in more than 140 publications across the country, including the Philadelphia Daily News, the LA Times, Village Voice, San Jose Mercury News, New York Times, other papers. He's published three collections of his cartoons. He writes a weekly op-ed column and has authored four prose and graphic books. He has recently published a couple of collections, that is, the last couple of years, collections of alternative cartoonists. They're titled Attitude, The New Subversive Political Cartoonist. At least that was the first one from 2002. There's also now a second edition, and as he said earlier in the interview, there will now be a third, and those will be cartoonists, all of whom appear on the internet. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 1996 and also was awarded in 1998 the Deadline Club Award by the Society of Professional Journalists for his cartoons. He's here on the campus to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. This is this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus, open to anybody who would like to attend. He's also here on the program. If you have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Someone listening in Indiana, we'll get to them, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Just came out of the doctor's office, so this question may have already been examined. I just heard you say that, you know, the Democrats basically rolled over and have not doing too much about for criticism. I know some of the literature they send out to Democrats, such as myself, they get sort of blistering in that, but I have to admit, in terms of on the Senate floor and House of Representatives, things are a little calmer. I was wondering if you could give your view why you think this has happened. I have a view on it, but I've never heard it spoken about too much, so I just wondered what, you know, someone who's more or less in the national scene could give me some insight on that. Thanks.
Well, you know, I don't know what these guys are thinking any more than you do, I think. But I know from what the people I have spoken to and read that this is a strategy that sort of goes back to it's kind of a time honored strategy to let your enemies hang themselves. Yeah, when you're in the minority, when you're in the political minority, it often behooves you to let the majority get their way because with your help, because they will anyway. So you vote along with them. They get their tax cuts. They get their Patriot Act. They get their war. They get whatever they want, and then you hope that it goes sour, and then you'll reap the political whirlwind. It's an old idea, and it's most recently been espoused by the Democratic Leadership Council, the group of centrist Democrats that was co-founded by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. And this is what we've seen essentially since Reagan. Democrats have voted along with most major Republican initiatives. There's people who hold out. Ted Kennedy voted against John Roberts. But for the most part, it doesn't. They just roll over to get along. And of course, obviously, there's also the fact that these guys get too close. You know, they make friends. Ted Kennedy is friends with Orrin Hatch. I've met Orrin Hatch. He's a really nice guy. It's easy to get charmed. And when you work together and set aside your political differences and go out for dinner, it's a little harder to be ferocious. So the system gets pretty incestuous after a while. So I think there's a lot of things going on. And of course, I could be completely wrong. This is just it's my guess. I think that what these senators and congressmen have forgotten is that they're – this is not a Democratic versus Republican thing. I think it's true of any party – is that constituents don't elect them to compromise. They elect them to represent their interests. So when a Republican congressman goes to Washington, he's there to represent his district and to promote Republican platform planks. And the same thing is true about a Democratic congressman. And, and they're supposed to get in there and fight it out and let the majority win. And, compromise will happen naturally. But compromise, you don't start out compromising. It's like negotiating at a flea market. You offer a very low price. You don't offer what they're asking for. I think that's what's going on. But I don't have any special insight. I'm just guessing. It's something I've wondered about for years.
All right. Well, let's talk somebody in Urbana here next. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah. I was on ucomics.com, I think it is, when I heard you were coming up, because I'm not that familiar with your work. But it has a lot of your cartoons, and they're really, really very funny and right on. I really like the one. I only got to about four or five, but every one of them was good. And I really like the one where you've got a journalist who wants a female journalist who wants her Pulitzer sent to Aspen after she cuts and pastes the administration press releases into her award-winning news story. And
that would be Judith Miller.
I was going to say it looked a lot like Judith Miller. Really good. And but I wanted—I don't know that much about syndicated cartoonists, but I imagine you know how many papers actually take up and print your cartoons when they do. And I was wondering if there's one cartoon in particular that everybody was hands off on, or. Maybe there's a particular area or topic that you find that the papers aren't picking up.
That's a great question. Actually, I don't really know. I don't have a good sense of who runs what. The way syndication works is that the cartoons go out to the papers. The papers have the chance. I do three a week, and the papers can run one, two, three, or zero. I have clients that receive my cartoons every week and don't run any, and then suddenly they'll run two in a week. And then there's other clients that religiously every week run one or two in the same spot with my name over it. And it's all over the place. And obviously, I don't want to receive 140 newspapers at home, or I'd have one hell of a recycling situation on my hands. So I don't know. I don't see the vast majority of the papers that ever run me. The only way I ever get to find out is by going to libraries that have a lot of out-of-town newspapers. And that being said, though, I do get kind of a sense of the topics that fly and the topics that don't. And the topics that there's certain commonalities, but the one thing that I have never been able to understand, or I should say I understand, but it's just something that is amazing to me, is that cartoons that criticize world free trade or free trade agreements like NAFTA and the WTO, et cetera, are almost impossible to get into print. And I've discussed this with Tom Tomorrow, who is another cartoonist who does the same sort of thing that I do. And he had the same exact he's observed the same phenomenon. Other cartoonists will say the same thing. They just can't get newspapers to print anti-NAFTA or anti-free trade cartoons. And I think, you know, our theory is that because newspapers are owned by large corporations, conglomerates that are businesses and are militantly pro-free trade, that they just don't go near it. So it's ironic. You can pick on the president, but you don't touch free trade. And yet, you know, most Americans are opposed to those free trade agreements. So it's it's a weird thing.
That's really telling, because it seems, I mean, I've a lot of things being written about the U.S., a lot of them point out how we pretty much deny the economic self-determination of so many different countries, the IMF and the World Bank and all that. It's like you're really hitting the core way we create wealth, and nobody's going to touch that. And thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks.
I'm one. We've talked a little bit about American politics and what you can do in cartoons and what you can't. I guess I can't get away from I've been sitting here thinking as we've been talking about the earlier caller who asked, what can you make a joke about and what can't you?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I find myself increasingly distressed by the idea that anybody, no matter who the president was or where you were in the political spectrum, would sort of get a chuckle out of the idea of the president's plane crashing.
Yeah.
I think that's
scary,
really
huh?
Ugly. And I find myself thinking, well, for example, you know, so that's someone obviously who is politically liberal. I mean, if we were at a time when, say, Bill Clinton was president and somebody who was obviously politically conservative made a joke about the president's plane crashing, you know, we would be outraged and we would
sure.
say that's about the ugliest thing I've ever heard in my life. I mean, I guess, and sometimes I find myself personally, you know, distressed by the tone of politics, and I think maybe what I really like to do is just go home, close my door, and seek whatever solace I can. And if you people out there want to go burn each other's houses down, do it, but stay away from my neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess how you – and once you get yourself in that place, I don't know how you get out of it. I mean, how does one – you know, you can be fierce, and,
yeah.
and you should be. But it's got to be constructive somehow. I mean, it can't
it's
be
civilized.
Well, okay.
When I was talking I referenced Orrin Hatch, the way I met him is he gave a speech at the Editorial Cartoonist Convention, and he turns out to have been a fan of my work, surprisingly.
Very surprisingly.
And,
yeah.
and he went to, and anyway, he wanted to have drinks. So we did. Well, you know, he had Coke because he's a Mormon. And but I had a beer, and he was he was a really nice guy, and there were several of my liberal peers. Bear in mind, this was all back before Bush came into office, so before things got really ugly, and many of my liberal peers were furious at me and wouldn't talk to me after they saw me hanging out with Hatch, because they said, you know, why were you so nice to him? Why weren't you yelling at him? Why didn't you like spit in his eye? I was like, are you out of your mind? It's like, you know, if I met Bush, I'd shake his hand. I'd be a nice guy. I would tell him in a polite, respectful way that I thought that I disagreed with him and that he thought he needed to change things. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's my main objection to the Republicans is that they're uncivilized. I mean, that's so, therefore, how can you be, you know, you can be fierce and still be civilized.
Mm-hmm.
But it is difficult, you know, once you get into the trenches. I mean, you know, I think that the that the, you know, I remember when Ronald Reagan was shot, I was 18. I cried. And yet I hated him. I thought that, I mean, he canceled my college scholarship. I had ended up having to work 40-hour weeks while I was in school because of Ronald Reagan. Yet I still cried because, you know, he'd gotten shot. And I think, you know, I'd hate to get away from that. You know, anyone who's civilized doesn't want anyone to die, not even bad people. I do think that George Bush should warm the inside of a very well-appointed prison cell for the rest of his life, and he should be treated very well in that prison and have anything he wants and watch TV and read, but he should be in prison. You know, it's a very difficult place to be, and I think that, you know, I'm not as judgmental about that caller because as maybe I should be, because I understand that what you're really seeing there is like a frustration, right? I mean, that guy, he's not, you know, he just doesn't know what to do. And in a way, the reason he feels that way is because of the fact that there's no party there fighting for him and like trying to, you know, when people feel impotent, they turn violent. That's what happens. We saw that on 9/11. You know, if Osama could have written a letter to the editor and had someone read it, you know, he wouldn't have hired those 19 guys.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. If you're interested in finding out more about Ted Rawl and his work, you can, well, for example, you can go to his website, which is tedrawl.com, and you can learn more about him. His work appears in papers all across the country. He's published several collections of cartoons. If you're interested in sampling some of the people who do alternative political cartooning as he does, he has a couple of books, two collections, Attitude, The New Subversive Political Cartoonist, and Attitude 2, and then coming soon, the third book, which will be all cartoonists who work on the internet. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, has won other awards for his work. He was one of the New York Times' most reprinted cartoonists in 97, 99, and 2001. And he's going to be giving a talk this afternoon here on the U of I campus. This is a talk in the MillerCom series, and that's at the Levis Center this afternoon at 4 o'clock. And anybody who is interested should feel welcome to attend. These talks are always free and open to the public. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Focus 580, this program is made possible in part with funds from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Programming is also made possible by a grant from Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. A little later today here on AM 580, we'll have a glimpse of America's history through the lens of women's letters. Following the 1 o'clock news today, Celeste Quinn, the host for the afternoon magazine, will be talking with writer and editor Lisa Grunewald. She and her husband, Stephen Adler, are the editors of a new book entitled Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. The program itself gets underway at noon with news and sports and weather and other things. Celeste Quinn is the host. The next hour of this program, we'll be talking about human rights around the world and the work of Amnesty International, and our guest will be Kurt Gehring. He's the Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. First, though, we're going to take a break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, the Chicago Board of Trade. It's been a huge day thus far in the soybean pit. The nearby is up over a dollar.